American Church History, Part 1, the ninth talk in a series entitled Church History, was presented by Peter Waringa on May 29, 2007, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
You can imagine we are going to look at American church history from about 30,000 feet. We're just going to get an overview, look at some of the highs and lows, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to leave some time at the end of class next week for you to just toss out any final questions, comments, observations you have about American church or about church history in general, not just American church history. But American church history is fascinating, obviously, should be for all of us, because we are still a part of it. American church history is still unfolding. We're participating in it. We're learning from it. We're experiencing it ourselves. So it's something that is of immediate interest to all of us. And I wanted to start off just by sharing with you a little bit of my history. And some of you are about the same age that I am. Some of you are a lot younger. Most of you are a lot younger. But let me just go back to some of my experience back in the 60s. Now, I spent the 60s, it was actually the latter part of the 60s, early 70s, living in Southern California when the Jesus movement was in its heyday. And I had my experience was this very odd mixture of being right in the middle of the Jesus movement. Calvary Chapel was just getting its start. I don't know if Melody Land, I don't know if that means anything to any of you. Campus Crusade for Christ was down in Arrowhead Springs. There was just so much going on so many different fronts. Southern California was a real hotbed. But at the time, I was also, and this may, some of you may pick up on some of the significance of this, some of you may not. My whole family was a part of Robert Schuller's church. Does the name Robert Schuller mean anything to any of you? The Crystal Cathedral, the Hour of Power, any of those. Robert Schuller was, his distinction in the history of the Christian church in America was he was the one who began the idea of a drive-in church down in Garden Grove in Southern California. He moved there in the mid-50s, moved to Southern California and began preaching from the roof of a drive-in, of the snack stand at a drive-in movie theater in Orange County, California. And within 10, 15 years, he had what truly was one of the early mega churches and had built a huge sanctuary, eventually built a 12-story office building that had classroom spaces, offices, all that sort of thing, and then eventually built the Crystal Cathedral. And to this day, he's still on TV. I don't know if he's on the networks anymore, on cable. I'm not sure what.
He's on Fox.
He's on Fox, is he? Okay. Well, Bob Jr., I have the distinction. I personally have the distinction of having hit Bob Jr. smack dab in the middle of the forehead with a walnut from the walnut orchard whereupon the Crystal Cathedral is now built. So a link, that's my link to fame right there. No. There you go. We could all get out of purgatory if I still had that walnut. But, nope, the walnut is long gone. But my family was very involved in the church. Bob Schuller, is Dutch. Part of what was the Dutch Reformed Church, the Reformed Church in America, is the name of the denomination now. But you can imagine, I had this odd thing going on where I was a part of the Crystal Cathedral. Then it was just Garden Grove Community Church, but at the same time, dabbling with and involved in the countercultural Christian movement. And I can remember very distinctly going to a series of meetings. This was probably when I was a sophomore, junior in high school, going to a series of meetings that were basically, this was in Orange County, was a very conservative part of the country, and I went to a series of meetings that were sort of a Christian anti-communist, it was just one meeting, a Christian anti-communist meeting, if you can picture that. Bob Schuller was the featured speaker, and there were others. And I remember sitting there and trying to process in my mind the way Christianity was being linked so strongly to being American. And it just didn't fit. I mean, even with what little I knew about the history of the church at the time, with what little I knew about what the scriptures had to say about those sorts of things, it just didn't fit for me. It didn't make sense. But there was this suggestion that Christianity truly was inextricably tied to the destiny of the United States and American culture. Well, at the same time, you have the counterculture movement that is absolutely wrestling with, thrashing, and struggling with the established church and trying to figure out, okay, what really is true in the church? What really are our principles? What are the things that are important to us in the church? So we have that going on in the Jesus movement, the countercultural movement, but at the same time I have this other significant influence, and it all led to lots of questions, lots of things I was trying to sort through, trying to work through. And in the midst of that, and this is again just part of my personal history, in the midst of that, there was, I don't know if any of you have ever heard of the singer Barry Maguire. Barry Maguire was a folk singer back in the mid-60s. His biggest hit was The Eve of Destruction, which is considered the classic protest song, recorded in 63, and it was somewhat in response to 63, or I think it was 65, somewhere in there. It was somewhat in response to what was the growing involvement in Vietnam, but it was also in response to the civil rights movement. It was in response to those of us who grew up in the 50s and 60s remember the fear of nuclear holocaust at the time. So all of this was going on. Barry Maguire sings this song, Eve of Destruction, basically about how the world is falling apart. But then later, a few years later, Barry Maguire became a Christian, and by, it had to have been the late 60s, early 70s, Barry Maguire was not simply, he was no longer talking about the eve of destruction. That was no longer his final word on things. But he would sing this version of the eve of destruction that began with he would sing the eve of destruction, and then he would transition into a quote from 2 Chronicles 7:14. 2 Chronicles 7:14, I mean, from those days, it's almost burned into my memory. I'll probably forget it as I'm going through it, but basically lifted pretty much right out of context were the words from 2 Chronicles 7:14 saying, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, I will hear from heaven and heal their land. I'm sure I missed something in there, but that's the gist of what he was saying. And his point was, if only the Christians, it really extended beyond the Christians, if only those who lived in America who in some way, shape, or form considered themselves tied to Christianity, if only they would humble themselves and pray and turn to God and turn from their evil ways, then God would take care of the country. And that was a clear message that God would favor the nation if the people who in any way, shape, or form considered themselves to be Christians would turn again to God. So it was a call to revival. It was a call for evangelism. All those things were wrapped up. But part of it, for me, part of the message that I got out of it, again, was this idea that somehow or other, as a nation, we were inextricably wrapped up with God's plan as a chosen nation. And that was something that I always struggled with. I could never quite come to grips with. Well, that idea of America as a chosen nation is a part of the very core of our human or of our national self-perception. That is a part of the way people think about what it is to be an American. I would guess, in the 40s, 50s, early 60s, there was still a very widespread perception all across the country that we basically were a Christian nation, that if you lived in America, you were basically a Christian unless you, for some reason, strongly disavowed Christianity. That was just kind of a given in people's perception. Well, that all got shaken up quite a bit in the 60s, particularly with the countercultural movement, when so many of the values, the principles, so many of the ideals of previous generations were tossed over, when religion was really looked down upon, rejected in many respects. And so I don't think it would be safe to, I'm sure there are some parts of the country that still perceive that if you're an American, you're in some sense a Christian. I'm sure there are places that is still widely understood. But for the most part, we really have gotten away from that perception. I remember, again, back in the 60s, 70s, reading Francis Schaeffer's book, Death in the City, and his opening words in that book are, I wish I could remember exactly what he said. Basically, what he's saying is, we now live in a post-Christian world. And when I read that, that was shocking to me. That was a surprise to me, because at that young age, I was still wrestling with this whole understanding of who I was as an American, who I was as an individual who had grown up in the church, and trying to figure out, okay, how do those fit together? Well, the first part of what I want to talk about today is the fact that much of our self-perception from the very beginning of our nation really was based on this idea that we were in some sense a chosen nation, in some sense God's new Israel was the phrase that was commonly used. And that sense has really helped to shape an awful lot of American history, not just in the church, but even beyond the church. And I would suggest has often shaped American history in many respects to our detriment. There are things, I think, that have gone on in the country that have been an expression of this idea that God has chosen us to do something, or God has specifically called us to do that, when that assumption might very well be presumptuous. Now, I'm not saying that God can't use any nation, any people, any society that he chooses to use. That's his prerogative. But to think that America as a nation somehow or other is uniquely and only in the 21st century called by God as a nation for specific purposes, I don't agree with that idea. I don't accept that. But that is, to a large degree, much of the perception that the church has had in America for many years. Well, let me go back and let's go through some history. Let's talk about where that idea came from. We're going to do that for the first part of the lecture, and then the later part of the talk this evening is going to be about revivalism in America, because revivalism has done a huge amount, likewise, to shape American self-perception, but also to shape the perception that the church has of it itself. But first of all, let's talk about this whole idea of America as God's new Israel. And what I'm going to suggest to you is this is not the first time in history that a people, a group of people, have had that perception. We've talked over the last several weeks about what was going on with the church in the Middle Ages, the sense that all of Europe was the, I've used the phrase, the corpus Christianum, that's Latin for the body of Christ, the sense that all of Western civilization, in that sense, Europe, in fact expressed God's plan, God's purpose in the world at that time. That was the perception of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages. So that this idea that a group of people or a society, a culture, is chosen by God is nothing new. And obviously that comes from the Old Testament understanding of God's having chosen the Jews. I would suggest that the only nation that God has specifically singled out in any sense for specific purposes in history for a long period of time would be the Jews in the Old Testament. Yes, he's used other nations. Yes, he has raised up other nations for specific purposes at specific times. But in terms of a nation, a people being chosen long-term for God's purposes, I'm going to suggest that that the Jews of the Old Testament are the only people that that description fits. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church saw themselves as the embodiment of God's activity in the world. And then we talked last week, or the week, I think it was last week, we talked about what was going on in England. In England, there was the clear perception, the clear belief that England was God's new Israel. Fox's Book of Martyrs was written in 1563, just 5 years after the death of Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, as she is known to us in history. And you'll remember that under Mary, the Protestants were run out of the country. There were Protestant martyrs. There were about 300 Protestants who were killed, most of them burned at the stake under Mary. And so there were churchmen, Protestants, who spread all over the world. And when they came back with a fervency and a desire to build the Protestant church in England in reaction to what had gone on under Mary. Well, John Fox wrote Fox's Book of Martyrs. If you picked up a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs, you would find there are some accounts of martyrs in the early church, but John Fox really gets going when he talks about the martyrs during the Protestant Reformation, and he really gets going when he talks about the martyrs in the church in England, because that's really his focus. John Fox's focus was to shine a light on what was going on in the Church of England, and his reason was because he truly believed and wanted to provide an apology for the idea that that England was God's chosen people. And a fact that I learned many, many years ago that is little known is that Fox's Book of Martyrs was, for about 100, 150, well, a couple hundred years, was second only to the Bible in its use in English-speaking households. You couldn't go anywhere in England, in America, for many years without finding a copy of Fox's Book of Martyrs there. Tremendously influential book. Well, that was John Fox's purpose. There was another book that was published, Polydor Virgil's Anglica History. It was actually published prior to this time in 1535, right in the middle of, this is just a few years after the Reformation was begun in England. And part of his history of England was talking about the idea that Joseph of Arimathea had actually been the one who had planted the church in England. That he had traveled to England after Jesus' death as a missionary, and that he was the one who had planted the church. The idea there was the Church of England needed to have basically a line of succession or a history, a tradition that went back to Jesus' time. And it wasn't going to be through the apostles. The Church of Rome had already claimed that with Peter as the first bishop of Rome. So Joseph of Arimathea was the substitute. He was the one in... according to Polydor Virgil, he was the one who had founded the Church of England. And then I mentioned this last week that in the late 16th century, when the Spanish Armada came to crush England and to restore Catholicism to England, and by a mighty act of God, the Armada was destroyed in the English Channel by an unexpected storm. for the English, that was proof positive that God was on their side. That was proof positive that he was protecting the church. He was taking care of them, and they were, in fact, in their mind, they were, in fact, God's chosen people. Well, that sentiment found its way right across the Atlantic Ocean. If you'll remember your American history, this is when folks were beginning to travel to the Americas, beginning to establish colonies. In the early 17th century was when the first permanent colonies were established. So within 30, 40 years of the defeat of the Spanish Armada, within 20 years of the death of Queen Elizabeth, the colonies are being established in the Americas. And along with those colonists came this idea of chosenness. We talked last week about the role of the Puritans in the church in England. The Puritans in the church in England were the ones who didn't feel as though the Protestant Reformation in England had gone far enough. They wanted to see the church purified even further, rightfully so, because the church in England at the time was a mixture of part Protestant, part Catholic, didn't quite know which it was. The church would lean one way or the other, depending on who was king, depending on who the king's advisors were. And by the time we got to the early 17th century, James I is king of England, then his son Charles I. Both of them were leaning back toward Catholicism, surrounded themselves with advisors who were primarily Catholic, at the very time that Parliament was primarily Protestant. And so there was this conflict that was going on in the nation, but in the church we had the Puritans who saw this struggle and didn't feel as though the Reformation had ever been allowed to go to the lengths that it was supposed to go in purifying the church. So the Puritans, some of them stayed in England. That was the basis for the Puritan Revolution when Oliver Cromwell in Parliament overthrew Charles II, eventually had him beheaded. We mentioned that this last week. But it was also the reason why many people left England. Some of them went to the continent, depending on what they thought the mood was in England at the time. But then many of those folks eventually went over to the Americas, to this newly or recently, relatively recently discovered land, to begin to settle there. Because imagine what better opportunity there could possibly be to purify the church than to do this in this completely unsettled land. They had the opportunity to go with no other people there to get in their way. They were far from the king, far from the parliament. They were able to see the church purified in a way that they couldn't see that happen in England or in the Netherlands, where many of them had fled from England. So it provided a phenomenal opportunity from right around 1620, when the first permanent settlements were established, to 1640. During that 20-year period, there were lots of Puritans who came to the Americas. A lot of that ended with the Puritan Revolution, because at that point, when Charles I was overthrown, when Parliament was in control, the Puritans didn't feel as much need to leave England. So there was a strong movement from about 1620 to 1640. But that set the tone, if you will, for what was going on in many of the colonies. So there's this biblical imagery that you'll see in the writings, in the teaching, in the sermons, in the letters. There's this biblical imagery that you'll see of what people's thoughts were, their expectations were about going to settle this new land. There was the idea that in Europe they had been in bondage, just like the Jews had been in bondage in Egypt. There's that imagery that comes through very often. There's this sense of entering into a promised land, this new unsettled country, this sense of moving to a place that can be a light. William Penn spoke of the colonization of present-day Pennsylvania as a holy experiment. He was very specific about his goals. William Penn was a Quaker, so you found not just the Puritans, but you found other folks who were not not as well received by the Anglican Church, who were going to help settle the New World. So Pennsylvania for William Penn was a holy experiment. John Winthrop, who became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, spoke of their enterprise as a city set on a hill. You have all of this imagery of the chosenness and the unique opportunities that are available to people who are settling in the colonies. Well, we talked about what was going on in England, about the Puritan foundations that were going on there. Just a side note, there was the Civil War in England in the 1640s. Charles was convicted of treason. He was beheaded for a very short time. England was a democracy, and you can see how that helped to shape the ideals of government that were carried over to the colonies. When Parliament took over, they got rid of the king, actually had him beheaded. You could see how some of those political ideals transferred over to the colonies as well. But that was actually relatively short-lived. That was only 10, 15 years. In 1660, Charles II was coronated. Oliver Cromwell had died 2 years earlier in 1658. Charles II was coronated in 1660, at which point the royalists, who were the folks that had brought Charles II back, the royalists at that point dug up Oliver Cromwell's body, hung him, and beheaded him. I'm not sure just why, but that's what they did in those days. So, like they did Wycliffe. In England, then you have the swing back from democracy and from Parliament, the Puritan Parliament being in control, to bringing back the king. And with the king coming back, there was again, this movement, subtle movement back toward Catholicism. And to this day, in England, we're still seeing, even within the last couple of years, we're still seeing serious discussions between the Church of England and the Catholic Church about reuniting. The two have never been that far apart. They've never been that distinct. And now very serious discussions are going on about finding ways to possibly reunite the two churches. But in the meantime, the radicals have gone off to the colonies. The Puritans have gone off to the Americas. In America, the Bible was clearly used as a guide for forming associations, for forming governments. It was a guiding principle. There is a very fundamental Augustinian and Calvinistic view and understanding that was carried over to the colonies with the Puritans. Along with that, though, was the understanding that the sinfulness of man, the depravity of man, made it essential to set up a rule of law rather than simply a rule of a king. So there you can see, along with their theology, comes some principles for how they're going to govern themselves and the type of government that they're going to set up. There's also, however, under the understanding of the sovereignty of God, there's also the desire to put limitations on the role of government. So all of these things are going on. They didn't want too much authority to rest in anyone, be it a pope or a king or anyone like that. They wanted to put some limitations on the authority that was invested in government. So all of this is going on in America during the early years. Now, it didn't take very long before the Enlightenment of the 17th century bore fruit in America as well. So I would suggest that by the time the colonies declared their independence, by the time the United States was formed, by the time the Constitution was set up, all that sort of thing, I would suggest that the founding fathers, by that time, were far more influenced, I don't know if I'd say far more, were as much influenced by Enlightenment thought as they were by biblical Christianity. There's actually an old friend of mine, a guy that I used to be on staff with back in Boise, he's formed an organization back in Idaho that is it's basically a public policy organization. And I get his emails every day about the things that he's working on. He sends them out to a large group of people. And he is adamant, I mean absolutely adamant, that America was formed as a Christian nation by Christians, that the founding fathers were consciously Christians. I think implicit in what he's saying, what he's suggesting, is that they were Christians like evangelicals are today, and that everything that they did was guided by their Christian principles. Well, I'm going to suggest that many of the founding fathers were more deists than they were Christians. Deism would be an outcome of the Enlightenment when, we talked a little bit about this a week or two ago also, with the Enlightenment came this further distancing from the authority of the church, distancing from the authority of the scriptures, and placing reason in the place of the authority of scriptures or the authority of the church. Well, for many of the founding fathers, they were far more influenced by deism, which is a, deism would remove from Christian tradition so much of what makes it true. It would remove from Christian tradition much of the understanding of who Jesus is, an understanding of miracles, an understanding of God's, what God is doing in the world. One of the things that has always amazed me about American church history was one of the things that Thomas Jefferson did. Thomas Jefferson was clearly a deist. And Thomas Jefferson, I always thought, you know, this is really a nervy thing to do. Thomas Jefferson basically created his own Bible, taking out of it that which smacked too much of supernaturalism, and leaving in it those parts that he thought were reasonable, the parts of the scriptures that he thought would be a reasonable religious perspective, he left in there. But if it smacked too much of any sort of supernatural intervention, he took it out. Well, that would describe pretty well the perspective of the deists. Still talk about God, but God as a more distant creator who was really not involved in the workings of the world, really not involved to a great degree in what was going on day in and day out, that would be more the perspective of the deist. Where is that? Is that a car radio or is somebody sitting on the lawn? Ah, they're having a party. Getting ready to have a party.
Break this up.
There you go. That's right. Oh.
You can speak it that way and say, the Lord will smite thee.
So, with the, my understanding is that when the country was founded, I don't believe that it was founded in any sense as a truly Christian nation, in the sense of founded by people who clearly themselves personally understood what the scriptures had to say and embraced those principles. There were lots of general principles that sincere Christians and deists and other religious people would all embrace, and a lot of those principles found their way into a lot of the things that were going on in the founding of the country. But I would suggest that America was not established clearly, simply, plainly as a Christian nation, as some people would say. Well, by the time the colonies had declared their independence, there was this deist flavor that carried over into the succeeding couple of centuries. And what I am going to suggest to you with regard to American self-perception is that we have maintained this form, if you will, of religiosity in the country without much substance to it. If you want to do a little experiment, reach into your pocket, pull out the coins that you have in your pocket, pull out any bills that you have in your wallet. On every coin you have in your pocket, you'll see the words, "In God we trust." Tain't true anymore. I mean, to suggest that we as a nation, in any sense, as a nation, as a people, trust in God, place our trust in God, that just isn't the case. That is not the defining characteristic of who we are as a nation. And yet there's this perception to this day. You will find politicians on both sides of the aisle, whether they're liberal, conservative, you'll find politicians on both sides who refer to God, who talk about praying, who talk about going to church, who talk about what the Bible has to say. So you'll find people who still use the language and still use the vernacular, but for whom there really is not much substance to their belief. And I would suggest that that's the way it is with most of America today. Back in the 70s, there was an individual by the name of Robert Bella, a sociologist who began to write about civil religion. And that is that's a fascinating topic. If you ever read up on that at some point, the whole idea of civil religion is this idea that there is in America, his definition was something like, there is a civil religion which exists alongside yet clearly differentiated from the churches. And what he would suggest is that the basic dogmas of this civil religion, which some people mistake for Christianity in America, but the basic dogmas of this civil religion have to do with a belief in the existence of God, the life to come, the reward of virtue, the punishment of vice, and the exclusion of religious intolerance. So those are some of the principles that Bella suggests make up the religion of our day. And for some people, that is still mistaken for Christianity. And for some people, they will still talk about America as being a Christian nation in some sense. But what Bella is saying, what I'm suggesting is that there's this religious form that has existed throughout the history of the country that is not true Christianity. Well, before I move on to talk about a different topic altogether, to talk a little bit about revivalism, let me just ask if there are any questions about that, any comments about that, any observations about that that subject. And I don't know, do we have the microphone? Walter, is it?
Well, it seemed as how, as I recall, that the decision of English being the American language as opposed to German came down to a very small vote. Was much of the German immigration for the same reasons as the English immigration at the same time, or do you?
I really am not an expert on the demographics of who immigrated where, when. So I really can't tell you exactly why there was such a large German immigration. I mean, my perception is that the English really did the colonies in the area of New England really did dominate the scene from very early on in terms of the motivation for independence from England, founding the country, the governing principles, all that sort of thing, and different parts of the colonies were settled for different reasons. For example, Georgia initially was a penal colony, and some of the states down south had more Spanish influence. So there were a lot of different areas that were settled by different peoples. But my understanding was that, certainly in New England, the English were the main settlers, other than the Dutch, who settled New Amsterdam first. But other than that, any other questions? Okay.
The founding fathers, I'm sure that a lot of founding fathers were Masons. So does the Masonic Lodge thing have a lot to do with the deism type of concept?
I am real sketchy on any sort of a history of Freemasonry or anything like that. So I've read little bits here and there, but I really could not. Here you ask two questions. I don't have much of an answer for either of them, but certainly you see some symbols from Freemasonry and some of the national symbolism, all that sort of thing, but exactly what the influence was and how insidious it might have been, I'm just not real up on that.
Okay.
All right. Sounds good. Yes. Jack and Daniel both.
Yeah, you may have addressed this already, but again, coming into what would eventually be the American South and Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything you can say about that and how that influence happens?
Not a whole lot. A lot of the early settlements in the South were Spanish. The French were very prominent in the South, and obviously Spain and France were basically Catholic. There was, in France, in the Reformation, there was a Protestant movement, but for the most part, it was underground. It was persecuted. It was repressed. There really was not much of a Protestant movement in Spain at all. So certainly, again, New England was settled primarily by the English, but the southern colonies had a lot of other influences other than just the English. And to this day, well, not in the colonies necessarily, but certainly Louisiana, places like that, there's much more influence that came over from the Caribbean as well, and from a lot of the Spanish settlements in the Caribbean, Central America, some of those places. Jack?
Can you emphasize the influence of deism as opposed to Christianity? What's at stake for you in that, or with your friend, what's at stake in calling it a Christian nation?
Well, for my friend, what's at stake for him is truly believing and expecting that a reasonable people would recognize that we're a Christian nation, and in that recognition would here today in 2007 would embrace, I mean, I don't think he would necessarily suggest embracing a theocracy, but not too far from it. Basically using, I've seen examples over the last several months of his taking the scriptures. His perspective is that the scriptures have something to say about every public policy issue. So, for example, just a couple months ago, he was talking about have been a movement to reintroduce wolves to Idaho. And wish I could quote chapter and verse for you, but basically, he pulled out of Deuteronomy, or I can't remember where he pulled it from, a verse that makes a reference to a disobedient people where wild animals still run loose. And his idea there was, look at what's happened to our society. I mean, here we are reintroducing wolves to Idaho when the very hallmark of a civilized Christian people is that the wild animals have been done away with. I mean, that was what he was saying. So for him, the idea is simply that the Bible would end up being a guidebook for every political decision, for every political principle that we were to have both on a city, state, and national level. For me, what's at stake is part of me would like to believe that. I mean, part of me would like to think that was the sort of role that God had in mind for the country that I live in, but I just don't see it. I mean, I just don't see biblically that he is any longer choosing one nation for a long period of time to specifically accomplish his purposes.
Does your friend's view include that notion that God specifically chose us to be a light to the nation?
Yeah, clearly. And I don't know if you remember, 15 years ago, The Light and the Glory, written by Peter Marshall. I mean, there was that period of time when The Light and the Glory was a very popular book. And I wish I could remember the specific details, but it was something like on the first page when he refers to Columbus discovering America in 1491. I mean, I don't remember what it was, but there was... Yeah, maybe it was. I mean, there was some historical event very early in the book that I knew the history. Every history book knew the history. He didn't seem to. That made me... It was sort of a wake-up call for me that Peter Marshall wasn't much of a historian. He had a specific purpose in writing the book, specific goal, and that is the idea that Christopher Columbus was the light bearer, came to discover America at God's direction. He had a very well laid out perspective there, but I could see that some of his history was just plain factually inaccurate. So that made me question some of his some of what he was trying to communicate.
Could you give us your opinion of what the role of religion in the founding of America was set out to be?
I think there was a very general sense. I mean, even the deists would have a general sense of God, a general sense of right and wrong, a general sense of some of those values. And so religion, in the most general terms, played a huge role in terms of shaping the values, shaping the principles, the governing principles, the way of doing things, but in a very, very general role.
So I'm thinking of, I mean, you have all these people coming from Europe where mm-hmm. there's a lot of bloodshed over religion.
Mm-hmm.
Are they trying, I mean, how much of a, are they trying to create a haven? And to what extent, if so?
Well, good, that's a very good observation. A lot of, I mean, you're right, in the 15th or in the 16th century on into the 17th century, Europe was just torn apart by religious wars. So a haven, yes, but not specifically for Christianity, because to the degree that some narrow form of Christianity, whether it's, I mean, by their definition, whether it's Protestantism, Catholicism, to the degree that some narrow form of Christianity created that conflict and brought about that battle, that warfare, well, then America was to be a place where there was no established religion, where there was a freedom for individuals to practice religion as they saw fit rather than establishing one state church. That was all of their background. Europeans' background was that each state decided either to establish one church, or in some cases, in Germany, establishing two churches, or in some countries, allowing two churches to coexist side by side. But there was always the idea that it would be best to have one state church. Well, that a reasonable person, a rational person, would see what happened when these Protestants and Catholics got after each other. So yeah, in America, let's have reasonable people allow for a freedom of religion that doesn't set in place one specific religious tradition.
So then, here's like what you think they might say to like the situation we find ourselves in today, which is where you have, you know, many different religions that perhaps conflict with each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was it like a haven for Christianity or atheism, so long as they didn't conflict, or even more so than that?
Well, I would say that that the founding fathers would almost universally, to them, atheism, as we see it today, I mean, that was really not on their radar screen. So it wasn't that they were trying to exclude religion from the public square at all. I mean, to that degree, there's some measure of agreement. Religion played a huge role in the founding of the country. And the whole idea of freedom of religion, rather than, as people talk about it today, rather than freedom from religion, that was not the guiding principle, was not to be free of any religion. It was simply to try and put an end to the conflict by allowing different religious traditions to coexist together. I mean, we had William Penn in Pennsylvania. We had Catholics who were settling colonies. We had Anglicans. We had Protestants. We had Catholics in the South. And the whole idea was, let's find a way to get along, not to exclude religion, but to not set up one religion. Anybody else? Any other questions?
That just brought up something. You said I think you said last week the Enlightenment ideas were to get away from religion to some degree to mm-hmm. escape the mm-hmm. idea mm-hmm. of God. But at the time of the founding of our country, even though people were really influenced by the Enlightenment, it wasn't, you're saying, still wanted to have a religion.
Yeah.
Still respect the religion.
Yeah, they're one of the vivid historical pictures in my mind is in France of reason being established as a god in France in place of any sort of Judeo-Christian understanding of who God is. So I think part of the Enlightenment, part of the intellectual movement of the Enlightenment really was to establish human reason above God. But it did not, I mean, certainly there were plenty of Enlightenment thinkers who didn't give much thought to God at all, or thought of God basically as there's the picture of the clockmaker God, the picture of some force that created things, set things in motion, and then left, and just left things to function on their own, not a personal God. So I don't claim to understand all of the fine points of what deists would, what their understanding of God would be, but certainly the God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament and the New Testament, was not the God that that deists had in mind when they talked about God. They might very well talk about God, but in terms of a clear biblical understanding of God, that would be lacking for the most part. Okay, any other questions or comments before we move on to another subject? Okay, well, we're going to move on to talk a little bit about revivalism. Revivalism is an interesting subject in the history of the church, and I'm not sure if we'll get through all of this today or not, but revivalism in America shaped the American church as much as virtually any other influence. Revivalism basically is, I don't want you to think narrowly of revivalism as tent meetings or as large gatherings. We think of revivals now in large arenas, that sort of thing. I don't want you to think simply of revivalism in that way. Think of revivalism more in the sense of what happens with a people when there has been a resurgence of religious interest, a resurgence of interest in religious subjects, specifically in the case that we're going to be talking about here, a resurgence of interest in Christianity that follows in cycles. It seems to happen, I would suggest, throughout the history of Western civilization in cycles, where the church will fall into a period of decline and decay and disinterest, and then there will be a period of renewed interest. We've talked about some of that as we talked about the history of the church. We've seen in the monastic movements. We've seen with individuals. We've seen with the Reformation itself. We've seen revival movements where there's a renewed interest in Christianity. Well, in America, it took its own unique form. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that there was a huge transition from what was happening with revivals in the early years of the colonies, long before American independence, and what is still going on today in revivalism. Let me just start off with a definition. There's an individual by the name of Calvin Colton who, back in, it was right around 1832, 1835, something like that, wrote a history of revivals. By that time, there had already been major revival movements in the Americas. He wrote a history of revivals, and his definition of a revival was, and this is a quote, he referred to a revival as the multiplied power of religion over a community of minds when the Spirit of God awakens Christians to special faith and effort and brings sinners to repentance. So you can see from a definition like that, it is not, a revival is not limited to a large meeting with a lot of people. he saw revivals, and what had gone on with revivals in the history of the country up to that point as being something that God was doing in reawakening people, sparking a new interest, calling people back to a better understanding of himself and of what the scriptures had to say. That was his understanding of what revivals were all about. Well, then back in the 1950s, there was another historian by the name of William McLaughlin who wrote a book on modern revivalism. He started with Charles Finney in his history of revivalism, and what he emphasized when it came to revivals, and this shows the shift, what he emphasized was the man-made nature of revivals, if you will. He emphasized the things that revivalists did in order to bring about revivals. And we'll talk about that here as we go through. But let me go back to the early years of the country. Let me give you a little bit of background. Talk about some of the revival movements in the early years of the colonies. And one thing that I should note for you that I really was not aware of until I studied church history is, again, we tend to think that in the colonies, in the 1600s, we tend to think that there was a fairly monolithic Christian consensus, that pretty much everybody in the colonies in those days was a Christian or had some sort of a strong religious commitment. Well, historians would suggest that in New England in the late 17th century and the early 18th century, so the late 1600s, early 1700s, in New England, only one out of eight people living in New England was a member of a church. In the middle colonies during those same years, it was one out of 15 people. In the southern colonies, it was one out of 20 people who affiliated themselves with the church. So this idea that those were the good old days when everybody was a part of a church, when everybody went to church, everybody considered themselves a Christian, that just isn't accurate. There was widespread disinterest in organized religion, disinterest in being a part of churches at the time. Now, I had mentioned, one of the things I had mentioned earlier is that there was really a different complexion to the colonies up and down the eastern seaboard, even to the point, as I said, that Georgia was begun as a penal colony. It was begun as a place to put prisoners. Well, it's understandable if not too many of them were interested in going to church, but that you see up and down the eastern seaboard a real variety in interest in organized religion. Well, Puritanism itself in the late 17th century was losing a lot of its vitality. Some interesting stories about what was going on with the churches in New England. In 1679, the Reforming Synod of Boston went through and cataloged in detail the sins of the community. And it read much like a catalog of the sins of this community would read. Debauchery, drunkenness, I mean, the same sorts of things were things that the Reforming Synod of Boston in 1679 was concerned about. As they looked around at their community, they saw many of the same sorts of things that we would be concerned about today. Even more striking was a few years earlier than that, in 1662, the Congregational Church, and when we talk about the Congregational Church in New England, in the New England colonies during this time, the Congregationalists were the hallmark of that group of people. They were people who believed that congregations should exist independently. It was not Congregationalist in the sense of a congregational church government. That's the way we think of it today, that the church is run by a vote of the congregation. Well, the sense of the Congregationalists back in the 1600s in the colonies was, as opposed to having a state church that basically had a hierarchy of bishops and authority figures, the congregational movement was made up of individual congregations, most of which were largely Calvinist at that time. Now, when we think about congregational churches, we do not think of them as being Calvinist or Reformed virtually at all. But in those days, the congregational churches were largely Calvinist. Well, in 1662, there was instituted what is known to historians as the Halfway Covenant. Fascinating what was going on, because the churches in New England at that time looked at what was going on with people in the churches, and they saw that the zeal and the enthusiasm of the first generation had died out, and they found that the children of the church members, the grandchildren of the church members, were no longer interested. They were no longer interested in being a part of the church and no longer interested in the teachings of the church. So they instituted the Halfway Covenant, which made provisions for someone to be baptized into the church and to become a member of the church, even if they didn't embrace the entire belief system and even if they didn't embrace all of the practices of the church. So provisions were made back in the 1660s. Provisions were made for succeeding generations showing no interest or showing very little interest in what was going on in the churches. And yet there was this sense that it was important for them to be a part of the church, so they instituted things like the Halfway Covenant to try to keep people in. Well, I go through all of that basically to say that that we would be wrong to think that in the 1600s there was a foundational basic belief in Christianity. That simply wasn't the case. They had a lot of the same sorts of things going on, a lot of the same sorts of disinterest, apathy that we would see in any generation. And it was into that scene then that one of the first revivals, or the first revival that is recognized by historians, came about. And this was in the early 1700s. When we found that there were individuals who simply by virtue of their preaching and teaching found that there was a reawakening, a revival in the towns and in the areas that they lived in. Let me just throw out a couple of names for you. In 1720, a man by the name of Theodore Frelinghuysen. Frelinghuysen was a Dutch Reformed pastor. He was a preacher. He lived from 1691 to 1748. Theodore Frelinghuysen, along with Gilbert Tennent, began preaching and began seeing a tremendous renewed interest, not only in their own congregations, but in surrounding areas and surrounding communities, with many more people coming to hear the preaching. And again, these folks, interestingly enough, these folks were dyed-in-the-wool Calvinists. You don't think of Calvinists as being folks that are in the forefront of revival movements at all. But in the Great Awakening, that's the revival, that's the name that has been given to this huge revival movement in the 18th century. The Great Awakening was largely brought about by good old-fashioned Calvinist preaching. Frelinghuysen, Gilbert Tennent were two of the early preachers. Jonathan Edwards, who lived from 1703 to 1758. Jonathan Edwards was a Congregationalist who was, in fact, himself a Calvinist in his theology primarily. Jonathan Edwards saw 300 members added to his church through his preaching, through a revival movement. Jonathan Edwards is widely thought of as one of the most brilliant men in American history, outstanding for his scholarship, thought of as a great theologian. Let me just mention a couple of the things that he wrote, that he preached. One of the things that he wrote, he was a bit of a historian for the Great Awakening. He wrote a faithful narrative of the surprising work of God in 1737. Now that gives you the perspective on revivalism that is a characteristic of the early revivals in America. For Jonathan Edwards, a revival was a surprising work of God. It was not something that man brought about. Jonathan Edwards would see himself, the others would see themselves, simply as faithful preachers of the word. And then it was up to God to bring about revival. And that is, in fact, what he was doing in New England at the time. Another sermon that Edwards preached, that he's well known for, he preached on July 8th, 1741. He preached a sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. Now, If any of you have been to a revival, if any of you have been to a, I mean, whether it's a small revival at a local church or a mid-sized or one of these, a large citywide revival or anything like that, imagine someone preaching on a theme like that, sinners in the hands of an angry God, as opposed to the recurring theme of so many of the revivalists today, a recurring theme of the love of God and just a very different emphasis, a very different focus in more contemporary revival preaching. In that sermon, and you gotta read it to really get a picture of it, but he has these vivid pictures of the sinfulness of man and of God's response to the sinfulness of man. Very different from what we see preached in our churches and in revivals today. Well, after Jonathan Edwards, or contemporary with Jonathan Edwards, was George Whitefield. George Whitefield was known as the Grand Itinerant because of his traveling. Edwards, Tennant, Frelinghuysen, those folks basically preached in their home church, and people came to hear them, and people were converted, and people showed interest coming to them to hear them preach. Whereas Whitefield came over from England. Whitefield's dates are 1714 to 1770, came over from England when he was only 26. He came over with one theological understanding, and under the training and tutelage of Jonathan Edwards, he himself became a devout Calvinist. So again, it's striking that in the Great Awakening, the primary theological perspective of the revivals of the Great Awakening was clearly a Calvinist perspective. So George Whitefield traveled extensively. He was an outstanding speaker. People loved to come hear him with his travelings. This was a change from the others, because he would go to different places and people would come from all over to hear him. Large open-air meetings, in many cases thousands of people coming to hear him at one time. From 1741 to 1742, there was just a large, very widespread revival going on in the colonies during that time, and it reached every social level. It reached every class of people, folks that were churched, folks that were unchurched, very widespread revival. Well, this movement, as I said, was staunchly Calvinist, and it for many years then helped to shape the predominant theological perspective of much of the church in America for many, many years to come. This was going on, as I said, up to around 1750 or so. So the Great Awakening was roughly a 20, 30-year period, around 1720 to the late 1740s, somewhere in there. But it reached into almost all of American society in the Northeast at this time. The southern colonies were very sparsely settled. Really, the hub of things was in the Northeast, and the Great Awakening affected all of the Northeast at this time. Well, after the Great Awakening, early in the 1800s came what is known as the Second Great Awakening. And the Second Great Awakening was already a dramatic shift from what was going on in the Great Awakening. In the Second Great Awakening, by this time, there had been a shift of interest from religion to politics. The Great Awakening really began around 1800, so just 24 years after the Declaration of Independence, 18, 20 years after the establishment of the country, the Constitution, all that sort of thing. So you see that there's been a shift of people's interest to politics, to the establishment of this new nation. And there's also been a movement out into the frontier. As kids, we were reading about Daniel Boone and those folks. Well, for them, the frontier was Kentucky and Tennessee and places like that for us are way back east. But for them, it was moving off the eastern seaboard, moving out into the frontier. And the revivals, the Second Great Awakening, really got started on the frontier, they referred to it as in the West. Well, the West was Kentucky. That's where the Second Great Awakening got started. And this was The Second Great Awakening was characterized much less by preaching that came out of established churches, individuals with established theological perspectives. It was a much more rough and tumble sort of affair, frontiersmen, open-air meetings abounding all over. And what you found was that the theology became much more mixed up already. You would already find with the Second Great Awakening that the preachers were much less biblically astute. They had much less biblical understanding, but still had a very widespread appeal in their preaching. James McGrady and others held huge open-air meetings. At the Cane Ridge Revival in 1801, there were 10 to 25,000 people attending this revival in open-air meetings with different preachers at different times all over. But some of these preachers actually had the vocal capability of being able to preach to 10,000 people in an open-air gathering and still be heard. So this was going on in the West. What happened then was very soon after this, after the revivals in the West, the Methodist circuit preachers came in and began to help organize churches, help organize the movement, so that in a very short amount of time, it was the Methodists with a very different theological perspective than the Calvinists. It was the Methodists who helped to shape the theology of the churches in the West. So that's a major change that's going on in the East, along the Eastern Seaboard. There's also a revival amongst the students of Virginia and Yale under President Timothy Dwight. Timothy Dwight was the grandson of Jonathan Edwards. There was a revival amongst the students there. There was the founding on the East Coast of societies like the American Bible Society, the American Home Missionary Society. So there was a revival on the East Coast also in the Northeast that took on a very different flavor. There was a lot going on with the universities, a lot going on with students, a lot going on with organizing societies for spreading the gospel, that sort of thing. But all this is going on in the early 19th century. And then not too long after this, we find coming on the scene, I'm going to kind of race through the last couple of people here. What, in my mind, what happened after the Second Great Awakening is there was this transition from revivals as being in any sense a spontaneous movement of God to revivals being something that is manufactured by the revivalist. Charles Finney is the one who started this trend. He lived from 1792 to 1875. At the age of 29, he was a lawyer. He was a very worldly, very sinful man when he was converted. He began to preach in nearby towns. By the late 1820s, he was a very popular preacher who was traveling extensively to preach. Now, theologically, he was not at all well-educated. Theologically, his theology was a real hodgepodge. He had himself ordained as a Presbyterian minister, claiming to be a Calvinist. And I say claiming, not because he was dishonest. I mean, he claimed to embrace Calvinism because that's what it meant to be a Presbyterian at the time. But when he actually looked at what the Presbyterians taught, when he actually looked at Calvinist doctrine, he disavowed most of it. He thoroughly turned against the teaching of the Presbyterian Church. So practically speaking, it was not his biblical teaching, it was not the content of what he was saying in his preaching that resonated people. Rather, it was the passion of his preaching. It was his enthusiasm. It was his ability to convince people. So it was his powers of persuasion more than anything else that brought about the revivals of Charles Finney. And one of the things that is actually, I mean, it's actually regained some popularity even in our generation. is he wrote lecture, or he spoke and then had written down his lectures on the revivals of religion. And we've seen that republished even in recent years. His lectures on the revivals of religion actually lay out the techniques that he used to bring about revival. And this, to me, is a truly scary thing, because we see the transition from seeing a revival as the spontaneous work of God and seeing it instead as something that can be manufactured. Let me just give you a couple points. In his lectures on the revivals of religion, some changes, and this is neither right or wrong, but some changes that he brought about. Women are encouraged to come in and testify and pray. There's a large organization that is formed in order to promote the revival, and we see this very commonly with today's major revivals, horse or house-to-house canvassing to invite people to the revivals in preparation for the revivals. But the things that to me are just a horrifying change in the way things that were done in revivals is he instituted things like the anxious bench or the waiting bench. The waiting bench was literally that. It was a bench at the front of the gathering where people who were experiencing some conviction by his powers of persuasion were invited to come forward and basically to sit on the bench and wait until, in fact, supposedly God moved in them to convert them. So it was a very public, very pressure-packed situation where people were in the meeting, coerced, manipulated, pushed to respond in some way rather than simply responding to the teaching. There were meetings at any and all times. It was not uncommon to have meetings late, not uncommon to have meetings that went on for long periods of time. Basically, and in some cases even overtly, to wear people down, to find people at a time that they're more vulnerable, when their defenses are down, and find in that an opportunity to see them converted was the idea there. Well, tremendous, in my mind, tremendous theological consequences. Here we have now the artificial promotion of revival. Nathaniel Taylor was a theologian for the movement. And with Nathaniel Taylor, there was clearly an Arminian emphasis that was in contradiction to a Calvinist emphasis. And the emphasis, you can see it in the revival techniques, it was basically all geared toward pushing for a way to have individuals make a choice by hook or by crook, essentially, with Finney and with subsequent revivalists, to push to have, find a way to coerce individuals to make a choice to follow God. Well, just a side note, we're going to talk real briefly about a couple of other revivalists. Just a side note, it was during this time that revivals were sweeping through upstate New York. Upstate New York became known as the burned over district. And the reason I bring it up is because during this time, revivals back and forth during this or in this particular geographic area. And we have seen then historically, we've seen all sorts of odd sects and cults that have come out of this particular geographic area, known at the time as the burned over district. We see Mormonism was founded in that area. Seventh-day Adventists began in that area. The Shakers, the Spiritualists. And again, I differentiate between sects and cults. Cults would be, in my mind, those that are clearly non-Christian. Sects might have some aspects of biblical Christianity, but perhaps not as much as we would like. But in this area, in upstate New York, we found that this religious fervor, this man-made, this manipulated, this coerced religious fervor swept through this area year after year after year, and all sorts of interesting and odd ideas came up out of this area. I'm going to talk just briefly about three other evangelists. Dwight L. Moody, his dates were 1837 to 1899. Dwight L. Moody was very poorly educated. He was a shoe salesman by trade, good shoe salesman, but a shoe salesman converted through the ministry of the YMCA. The YMCA was the Young Men's Christian Association. He moved to Chicago. He began preaching. From 1870 to 1899, he held many huge crusades in America. He spent several years over in England from 1873 to 1875, preaching over there, huge meetings. He used and improved upon Finney's techniques were called the New Measures. That was the name given to them. Well, he improved upon the New Measures and found other ways to try to prompt or coerce a response from people. And again, he was thoroughly inept as a theologian. And this, to me, is what became alarming about revivalism. In the Great Awakening, most of those men were basically good theologians, basically biblically literate. By the time you get to Dwight L. Moody, thoroughly inept as a theologian, emphasizing a purely emotional appeal to the love of God, very poor contextual biblical knowledge, strongly Arminian in his preaching, strong social gospel aspect to his preaching. All of this was going on. So by the time that Dwight L. Moody is finished with his revivals late in the 19th century, the whole tone, the whole tenor, if you will, of the church in America has changed. And many of the churches then have the same biblical illiteracy, have the same simplistic theological perspective that Dwight L. Moody had. And we'll talk just a little bit more about that this next week, perhaps. Just two other evangelists I'm going to mention briefly. Billy Sunday, and I'm going to mention Billy Sunday because I just got to read to you a little section about Billy Sunday and his crusades. He lived from 1863 to 1935. Most of us haven't heard very much about him, but in the early 1900s, he was a very famous nationwide revivalist. He was a former professional baseball player, converted in 1886, became an evangelist soon after that. His career peaked from 1914 to 1919 with revivals all over the major cities. Billy Sunday was an entertainer, plain and simple. I mean, not even attempted to be theologically accurate, not even no attempt whatsoever to preach biblically or anything like that. He was purely a showman and an entertainer. Let me read to you just a little bit about what Sidney Ahlstrom in his History of the Church in America has to say. This is about Billy Sunday, and this is a little bit longer reading, so bear with me. He says, Sunday's phenomenal success was due in no small part to his talent for dramatization before audiences. Accompanying his contortions, furniture smashing, and partial undressing was an unbroken torrent of words. What the church needed, he shouted, was fighting men of God, not hog-jowled, weasel-eyed, sponge-collared, mushy-mouthed, jelly-spined, pussy-footing, four-flushing Charlotte Russe Christians. Similar language was turned against the familiar sins of the world, high society, worldly amusements, filthy habits, pliable politicians, liberal preachers, trashy immigrants, and especially the booze traffic. Every man who was not a teetotaler was a dirty, low-down, whiskey-soaked, beer-guzzling, bull-necked, foul-mouthed hypocrite. Not only did he define sin almost solely in terms of individual moralism, but he garbled the distinction between the sin and the sinner in a way that simply fostered the self-righteousness of his middle-class audiences. The altar call was, of course, the climax and goal of the revival service. Professional evangelists had made the decision increasingly easier so that by Sunday's time, any decent American could painlessly respond. The burden was easy and the sawdust trail was wide. His invitation on the 12th day of his New York campaign was typical. Quote, do you want God's blessing on you, your home, your church, your nation, on New York? If you do, raise your hands. How many of you men and women will jump to your feet and come down and say, Bill, here's my hand for God, for home, for my native land, to live and conquer for Christ? And then Rody Rothauer and the choir began their musical accompaniment, and a sea of humanity surged forward, one out of every 10 in that audience of 20,000. Well, that brings us full circle to where I started this evening, where by the time you get to the revivals of Billy Sunday in the early 1900s, you have Americanism, being American, associated with what it means to be a Christian. If you're a decent human being, if you're willing to attend church, if you're willing to believe in some basic things, if you're willing to follow a certain moral code, well, you must be a Christian. So I would suggest to you that much of our self-perception in the church today came out of the revival movement, came from this transition from the, what I would suggest was good, clear teaching of the early revivalists, biblical teaching, sound theology for the most part, to the absolutely vacant theology deficient teaching and preaching of the revivalists later on. I've gone over. Anybody have a quick question or two before we move on? We can always take up questions again next week. Next week we're going to be talking about trying to summarize in one session much of the rest of what was going on in American church history, and then we'll try to leave more time for questions at the end. So thank you.